ever thought.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hey everybody, I'm Michael, your host for the Five Rivers Radio Hour. Our guest tonight is M. Maka Nightmare, who's an American neo-pagan priestess and a witch, who's been a mover and shaker in the American pagan community from its earliest years. She's one of the founders of the Reclaiming Collective in San Francisco in the 1970s, along with Starhawk and others. She's helped shape our community's approach to feminism, to ritual, goddess theology, the arts and sacred practice, folklore, scholarship, prison chaplaincy, and the necessity for cultural infrastructure that serves the needs of pagans. She's a skilled and innovative ritualist and a strong voice for interfaith bridge building. She's a co-author of the pagan book of Living and Dying. She's continued her work through organizations like the American Academy of Religion, the Nature Religious Scholars Network, the Council Treating with Elders, again, and with Cherry Hill Cemetery. So I knew I was going to say that. Cherry Hill Seminary. God, it's like when I was a kid and I didn't know the difference between marshmallows and mushrooms. Her current motto, which I love, is Have Broom, Will Travel. She sees herself as a person out there for the entire community, and she puts a broom where her mouth is. She's an expert in our history and a pathfinder for the future. But more than that, she has a deep, unshakable love for nature-based spirituality and the people who practice it. And on a personal, Maka is just one of my heroes. She's an amazing lady. Welcome, Maka, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I sound pretty impressive. can tell that I'm a generalist. I'm a generalist more than a specialist.
Yeah, and I personally think that's something that's very valuable at this point in our history as a pagan community. So, have I missed anything in your past? Anything you'd want to kind of give us a little bit of history of yourself? Anything you want to spotlight?
Well, I came at generational stamp on me that is not particularly evident among today's faith, but I do think that's one of the sources of contemporary paganism is second wave feminism, at least one of the motivators for people to explore further into other religions that are not the Abrahamic ones they grew up with. So, but I do death and dying stuff, and I run a prison ministry at San Quentin, and I participate as much as I can with the Claremont Pagan Studies Conference at the American Academy of Religion. Pagan studies, ritual studies, goddess studies, religion and the environment, ritual studies, new religious movements. Those are all categories within the academy. They meet every year. It's about 30,000. So it's pretty diverse.
So basically you're a pagan renaissance woman. I'm really curious about the prison ministry. It's not something we talk a lot about in the pagan community. How did you get involved in a prison ministry, and what's kind of the state of that right now for pagans here in California?
Well, it's an issue that's in flux all the time due to various lawsuits and stuff. I went into the prisons at...
Mike, I'm sorry, could you talk a little louder? I don't know if the listeners
are
having a problem, but I'm...
Is that better?
I have old ears. Yeah, that's much better.
Is that
thanks.
Better?
Yeah, great.
I went to a couple of prisons with my friend Patrick McCollum, who is relatively well known in the pagan prison world and beyond. I mean, but he's worked with inmates for 20, 30 years as a witch in his case. So I went into a couple of prisons with him just sort of to see what it was like. I'm not particularly called to it, but what ended up calling me to. I live near San Quentin, so I'm able to do a ministry there because I don't have to have to expense of traveling, eating, and, you know, gas and motels and stuff, which most people
right.
who do that work as volunteers, that's an expense they have. The other reason I answered the call, somebody put something on a local list saying they need somebody to go into the Wiccans at San Quentin. And I was kind of waiting for an invitation. When it came, there, I had been invited some years ago by a group called Friends Outside. And Friends Outside is a Christian group, but they were, you know, trying to serve a lot of different kinds of inmates. And I didn't go in then, even though I could have gone in with this woman, because there was a pending lawsuit that Patrick was one of the plaintiffs on. So, and it would have compromised the lawsuit, we all felt. So I didn't go in. But then when this next opportunity came up, I did. And I've been going there for almost a year. And it's a very interesting situation. Federal law mandates that inmates have religious counsel and opportunity to practice of their choice.
Right.
Prison is, you know, prison.
Now, when you're in the prison, do you? Is it a group that you're meeting with? Do you visit individual inmates?
I work with the group. There are religious counselors of various kinds who do speak with inmates one-on-one. I do not. That's a sort of different kind of area
yeah.
of volunteer. I meet with what is called, what they called when I met them, the Wiccan Circle. I think they called it. Covenant of the Eternal One, I think is what they call it. Anyway, they were called a Wiccan circle. In reality, Wiccan is just the kind of overall term for pagan stuff. There are heathen groups in most of the prisons. I'm not sure about San Quentin. I haven't seen any evidence of them. But there are Hawaiian groups, and gospel singers. I mean, there's all kinds of resources in San Quentin. That's, if you're going to be in prison in California, San Quentin's the place to be, because that's where volunteers.
We'll keep that recommendation in mind.
No,
remember,
I mean,
that, everybody, if you got to go to prison, go to San Quentin.
You have a choice.
One of the things that I heard a chaplain say, I think it was a Christian chaplain years ago, was this frustration with among certain prison populations. They associate the pagan thing, particularly the Celtic pagan stuff, with white supremacy. Have you run across any of that, and how do you deal with that?
I haven't encountered it directly. The white supremacists generally are of the heathen persuasion. And there are lots of reasons, even when they're not white supremacists, because of prison culture being it's so different from civilian culture, and we don't know it. But basically, it's my understanding that people who are incarcerated kind of need somebody to have their back. They can't just be loners.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
they're victims. So some people identify with one or another ethnic identity, some gang, you know, Asian gangs or gangs or black gangs or whatever, or white gangs, and that's comparable to white gangs. You know, it's more complex than that. But I have not had any direct encounter with it. When I first went in, I was working under the auspices of the Jewish chaplain, who is an employee, of, you know, a full-time employee of the prison, which we don't have a pagan chaplain in there as a full-time employee. The man in the circle requested a change of supervision, and now I work with the Native American chaplain. Native Americans have traditionally, at least in California, been very strong allies for our getting certain rights with Native Americans at this point.
Have the groups that you're working with been able to provide a substitute for you know, people supporting each other within the prisons? It's interesting you brought that up, because that's also one of the things that's talked about in certain poor neighborhoods around the country, that kids will get involved in gangs because
right.
it's the only way they have to be safe where they are. So do you think the groups like the Wiccan Circle are providing an opportunity for that?
Well, people in prison are a lot of poor people. I mean, just look.
That's,
you know, rich
true.
People
That's
pay
true.
To not get convicted and sent to prison. There's been all kinds of recent articles about that. And the other thing about prisons, which is not about pagans or non-pagans, is a huge proportion of the inmate population are veterans. Various wars.
Another one of your causes. I remember the fight not too long ago to allow the pentacle on graves in the government cemeteries. It was a really tough battle, but pagans eventually won.
Yeah, I can actually give you a little background on it. If you don't mind, I will do that.
That would be great.
For people to know. One is that I think it was Lady Liberty League, Selina Fox, et al. In Wisconsin, who originally petitioned to have a pentacle on the gravestones. The approval for what symbols get put on the gravestones comes from, I believe, the VA. It's not from the military itself. It's from the VA, which is a different, practically speaking. It took us 17 years and a lot of hassle. It normally is about a 90-day process. You apply and you jump through some hoops and they approve it. They had Adams for atheists, and they had Ekinkar and Baha'i and a lot of minority religions. Not to say anything about them, but a lot of minorities, they got approved in their 90 days. It was either 14 or 17 years. And if that isn't discrimination, I don't know what it is. Since then, it's within that time period. That happened a couple of years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago. Other pagan organizations have been able to get symbols on their gravestones. I don't know if Druids have done it yet, but I know that heathens have a hammer of Thor, so forth. Paved the way. We had to break that.
It's interesting that it was a struggle because, the military code includes Wicca as a recognized religion, if not other pagans.
Now it does.
Yeah.
1993, there was a whole hoopty-doo in Fort Hood about George Bush was saying Wicca's not a religion. I guess what I'm basically saying is that some of the Wiccans, there are more of us, have paved the way for other minority religions, pagan and otherwise, to enjoy the same rights as they are entitled to all along.
Yeah, I think that's something that's kind of common in any kind of civil rights movement for a small minority. The ones that have the courage to get out there and change things for themselves end up not just changing them for themselves, which is a good thing.
Sometimes it's courage. In our case, it was also numbers, because there's more of us.
Courage, numbers, stubbornness, all the things you need to do that kind of activism. So what about your, speaking of your work with veterans, I find it pretty difficult to deal with that we have so many veterans who are in prison. I think it's kind of a testament to how we don't help people integrate back into the culture. Do you work with veterans on the outside of the prisons as well, and what kind of form does that take?
I do not work with veterans in any form. I have worked with interfaith groups who are working with veterans. We don't really have the infrastructure to do much, and again, institutions.
Well, that actually brings me to another question I have for you. And it seems to be you're hitting this topic on multiple levels, and that's the sad lack of any kind of cultural infrastructure that for the pagan community. Where do you go to find a pagan doctor or a pagan lawyer So can you talk to that a little bit about how you're working to build infrastructure and how we need to do to build that infrastructure?
Well, there's a lot of mixed opinions about infrastructure. We arose from the counterculture. As such, we were oppositional. We were kind of, we don't need no stinking leaders kind of mindset. I'm using the term loosely for a lot of things that arose in the cultural, from the matrix of the 60s and 70s, the changes that were going on in society. And among them, of course, was the women's movement and paganism. But infrastructure, my main focus for infrastructure is a seminary, Cherry Hill Seminary, which is almost all online. It has many programs. You don't have to be a degree-seeking person to go there, but we do have, grant MDiv, Masters of Divinity, and Masters of Religious Studies, or Pagan Studies. I'm not really sure which it is. But We're not accredited yet. We're working on it. It's a very expensive project. We have the best teachers out there. I tend to recruit them from the American Academy of Religion meetings, Megan Zuddy's meetings and stuff. The current academic dean, a woman named Wendy Griffin, was the chair of the Women's Studies, Women's and Gender Studies. It got changed a few times over the course of her tenure there at Cal State Long Beach, and she's retired and sort of constitutionally incapable of retiring. And lucky us. So she's our academic dean, and she is also one of three or four people, including Chas Clifton and Michael York and Kat McEachern, who got the Pagan Studies section of the American Academy of Religion recognized as a full section, and we fast-tracked. We were so popular that we went through the process much quicker than others.
I personally have a lot of gratitude for the work you do in the interfaith work. I remember I was asked to be the first pagan on this religious group. I won't mention it because I don't want to badmouth anybody, but it was from one of the gay communities, you know, national organizations, and they were attempting to bring clergy together who were not homophobic to show that not all religious people are homophobic. And and while I wasn't treated badly as a gay man when it came to my paganism, there were still people there considering me a Satanist. Couldn't convince them I don't believe in the guy, let alone, you know, worship him. But so the progress that you've been making is really amazing. And the Bay Area seems to be kind of a hotbed of the interfaith stuff. Is that just because I'm close, or is that actually true? That a lot of the innovation is happening.
I'm not sure, because my involvement in interfaith is mostly local and regional. It's not so much national and international, although some. And I don't have the resources, nor do we have institutions to underwrite people like me to do stuff in the interfaith world. To go beyond. And the reason we have a strong presence in interfaith, in my opinion, is because there were people who did have personal resources who felt it was important enough that they were willing to put their time and money and efforts into these efforts. I don't know if the interfaith movement itself sort of got its big kickstart in 1993 with the celebration of the centennial of the Parliament of World Religions, which was convened in 1893 for the Chicago World's Fair. And there was a big reunion in 1993, and that's sort of when we came on the scene real big way. I could tell you a lot of stories about that, but I don't know that you want to know them. But in any case, the last year I was invited to a thing called Mountaintop, which was a strategic thing with religious leaders that was held at Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee. And but the sponsors were mostly New York and Washington, D.C., Eastern Seaboard-based institutions, primarily Auburn Theological Seminary, which is a 200-year-old Presbyterian seminary with a center for multi-faith education, where I've spoken in the past several times. But they chose Nashville for this meeting specifically because they didn't want to be on either coast, because there's a lot of action on the coast. There seemed to be a lot of resources. So in answer to your question, I think it's probably true that it's more coastally oriented, but, you know, so are progressive votes. Well, I would like to make a remark about interfaith that I think some people are under wrong impressions about, and that is we don't get together and talk about religion. We get together and focus on external things. It's not like who's – and the people who – choose to involve themselves in interfaith work are already broad-minded, open-minded, tolerant. We don't get the hardcore, Angela.
Well, yeah, I imagine it's, you know, so, when plumbers go to a convention, they don't all pull out their tools and fix pipes together, you know.
But a lot of people are under the impression that we talk about religion, and we do, of course, specific events where two or three people are invited to speak on two or three different religions or on topics. Like I once participated in a ritual, actually, which was about the return of the light. It was a winter, and they went through all these different fire ceremonies, and, you know, the Hanukkah candles, and Diwali, and Kwanzaa, and you know, the whole bit.
Yeah. I remember doing research when you're on. I'm sorry, go ahead.
They ask sometimes for teachings from your tradition, and there'll be a specific, you know, program where that you're supposed, that's what you're supposed to do. Otherwise, that's not what we talk about.
So is it... Is the primary focus just bringing people together to get to know each other? Do you guys do it? Is it an educational mission that you've got for each other? What kind of stuff do you actually do?
Well, I can tell you a few things. On the national, one of the things I was saying I hadn't done much with veterans, the United Religious Initiative, which is a, I think it's international, but it's definitely national group based at the chapel in the Presidio in San Francisco, United Religions Ministry, URI. They got some, they got some grant money somewhere, and they did a thing in Contra Costa County, which is near where I live, but not where I live, on what they called, I can't remember the title of it, except it was Understanding the Hidden Wounds of War was the underlying title. And it was for clergy people and leaders in various religious communities to help them understand the needs of returning veterans. I'm not a veteran, and I don't understand their needs, but one of the things that we pagans can, I believe, contribute to that end is a knowledge of ritual, because most established religions have also established liturgy. And it's kind of there. They don't necessarily think about doing it in a different way or, you know, changing it. We're much freer about that because we sort of had to learn on our own. So I
that sounds like that would actually
whopping,
be.
I had a whopping 5 minutes to talk about ritualizing returning home, based on that. Now that was not my local group. That was a national group that it was, and it was also several other related groups. And there were a lot of veterans there. They were saying we should do this every week. In every town in the U.S., blah, blah, blah. Now, a lot of these veterans have survived by finding Jesus or whatever. You know, I mean, I'm happy for them. It was, but it was overwhelmingly Abrahamic. I managed to get one blessing before the noontime meal by a Hindu friend from the Hindu American Foundation. And we had a whopping 5 minutes on through and I to do this ritual of lighting the drink home. However, it led to something bigger. When they did, a year or so later, they did another similar event, and they asked me to do an hour-long workshop on ritualizing the drink home, which I did. So that's what I've been able to do for veterans, and I have no idea if it ever amounted to anything. In the long run, people seemed grateful for it, and they wanted to apply some of the suggestions that I gave them, but that's what I know about that. But in terms of my local interfaith, I belong to Marin Interfaith Council, which is where I live, and of course, it's one of the oldest. It was founded in 82 when we had the, or 81 when they had, we had big floods. And one of the rabbis here, around here called one of his colleagues, who was a Protestant minister, and said, we got to do something about the homeless people who are encamped along the creek, alongside the creek, because they're going to get washed out, which in fact they did. And so they called their colleagues, and MIC was founded on external need, which was, what can we do for these homeless people whose tents, sleeping bags are being washed, you know, getting washed away. So we have two primary committees, and I worked on one for about 8 years. One is called Interfaith Celebration, excuse my thing. And they do celebrations of various kinds. And the other one is the Justice Advocacy Team, JAT. I'm going to say JAT because I trip myself when I say Justice Advocacy Team. But I worked on that for several years, and we worked on things like, you know, teen suicide, and, you know, what kind of speakers we're going to get for clergy lunch, and voting, and the barrier,
you know,
of the church.
I talk to people all over the country who are would love to have some sort of infrastructure in their community, and I think sometimes people look at New York and L.A. and San Francisco as having you know, so many people that it's easier to build that infrastructure. What for somebody in a mid-sized city somewhere in the country, how could they go about ball rolling as far as you know, elder support groups and veterans groups and interfaith groups in their own community? Is it always just have to be like one like really dynamic leader that starts it? Or do you have any advice for the people that are out there that are not in the big cities, what they could do to start providing that for the pagans in their area?
Well, it's a complex question, but I'll try to answer it piece by piece. I have a colleague in Columbia, South Carolina, which is not a very big city. It's a medium-sized city. It's the capital of the state, a conservative state. She was one of the people, she's a pagan, she's in fact the executive director of Cherry Hill Seminary. She helped to establish, what's it called, Interfaith Partners of South Carolina? I'm not exactly sure of the title. I could send it to you if there's any follow-up place for this show. But they established an interfaith council. She was a mover and shaker in that, but she wasn't the only one. And she managed, one of the people who's part of the council is father of Nikki Haley, who's the governor. Nikki Haley is a Methodist, but her father is a Sikh. Sikh or Sikh. And they got the state of South Carolina to declare a whole month Interfaith Appreciation Day or a month or something, you know, Interfaith Awareness, I think it was. So wow. They started something, and I'm happy to put you in touch with her if you want. The other thing is there is a blog on Paseos that's called Wild Garden, and it's about pagans in the interfaith movement. There's about
could you spell that out for people who are listening if they want to go search that?
I might even. Well, I was there the other day. It's paseos.com/blogs/wild garden. And wild garden,
wild garden.
Is metal is pagans in the growing interfaith landscape.
That's excellent. You know, I know with my work with other groups in civil rights that very often, at least initially, there's a necessity for us to take care of our own because it's hard, you know, to find places for our elders where they'd be perfectly free to be who they are and talk about what they talk about. I think it's time for that in the pagan community. I think it's past time that we start building some of those institutions.
I want to mention two other things, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
One is you need institutions to participate in the interface. In other words, an institution, for instance, when I joined MIC, they said, you know, what's the membership? It's proportionate to the size of your congregation. But we don't have congregations, at least witches don't, the way that bigger churches do. We don't have 30,000. We don't even have 200. We have a dozen, maybe, six or eight people who work together. I had to explain to them those kinds of differences. I happen to be, as delegate, one of the interface reps for the Covenant of the Goddess. And by the way, there is another set of blogs called, the COG has an interfaith blog. If you go to cog.org, it's right at the top of the page, COG interfaith blogs. That tells a lot of the stuff we've been doing over the little while. And but I have, it looks like I have an institution behind me because I have COG, but COG is really very, very small compared to Congregation Road of Shalom or St. Raphael's Church.
Right.
But I do have the, I don't know, for want of a better word, authority of an institution behind me. They don't do anything. I just have that name behind me. They don't underwrite anything I do, for instance. Sometimes they give me help, travel type and stuff, if they can. But, you know, it's not part of the, it's not set up like a, and I, so it's sort of one of those, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You have an institution you represent, or you have the institution, and then you know,
right,
the interfaith
right.
group really is an institution of sorts, and are you just kind of a loose pagan or witch or something or druid, or are you representing some group? You may be representing. I mean, somebody could represent ADF. Or I have a man coming in who's into interfaith who is Hispanic, and we don't have very many pagans in interfaith who are not witches, so that's great.
I remember when I went to that interfaith group years ago, and everybody went around at the beginning introducing themselves, and it was basically Christians, one Jew, and me. And but what was funny is that, you know, hi, I'm Pastor so-and-so, and I'm the vicar of the Fifth Synod of Area 5, you know, these long titles for what they did. And they got around to me, and there's just this wonderful black female pastor who was sitting next to me, and she introduced herself, also had a long title, and I just kind of went, hi, I'm Michael Gorman, I'm a druid. And she looked at me and smiled and said, oh, no, honey, you have to have more than that. Let's see, we'll call you the West Coast Druid Outreach Coordinator. I said, okay, now I have a big, long title like everybody. So one of the things that you seem to weave well into your work in interfaith as well as is veterans work is your work as a ritualist. I mean, I know you're one of the powers behind the annual circle dance in San Francisco, that you now travel around doing other rituals. And I recently went to a ritual of yours. It was based on Bridget, and you broke some of the stereotypes of what a pagan ritual should be. Could you talk about that a little bit? Your ritual to Bridget and how you structured that, because, you know, in teaching people like to have like a little template they can plug everything into, and yet you seem to encourage much more creativity than that. So how does that work out when you go around to different groups and you do things differently?
Well, I want to correct some misimpressions from the beginning of what you were just saying. The event is called the Spiral Dance, put on by Reclaiming. I was involved with
Spiral Dance, yeah. My brain just went blank.
From its inception until 2012, and I have disaffiliated, so I have nothing to do with it anymore. And whatever is getting done is getting done by other people. Nonetheless, that is part of what shaped who I was, and as a ritualist, it certainly helps shape me. I also have done a little bit. I'm an autodidact of sorts, but I taught ritual studies at the Dark Dance School for the Ministry, which is UU, online last spring, which was great, because I was trying to teach ritual theory and liturgical design that would be useful to anybody of any religious persuasion. And that is...
Yeah.
Part of what I was doing with Bridget Ritual that you were referring to was intentionally intended to be a devotional as opposed to some other, as opposed to, say, a celebration of a turning of the wheel or a work
right.
of some kind for change in the world, healing, or, you know, whatever. So it was intentionally structured to focus on a particular deity. Ooh, by the way, I just invoked before I made this phone call for this talk, so hopefully she's helping me. So I think that we get in kind of a ritual rut. One of the things that has been a very contentious discussion in the pagan monastery, at least in the last year or so, has been what people are calling Wiccanate privilege. I happen to really dislike the term. I understand what they mean by it, but I just think it's an ugly word. And I think that putting the word privilege after it is kind of sets up an opposition when really we're your allies. But the assumption is that when people say pagan, they think circles, quarters, Wiccan-ish
right.
sort of thing. Wiccan is...
I'm losing you a little bit, Maka.
I'm sorry.
It's just my old ears.
It's this little thing in my... I have a little... earbuds on with a little talky thing that turned around. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. I'm sorry. It sometimes turns away from my face as I move.
I wonder if people ever do that in the astral plane. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Probably.
There's probably ghosts wandering around the house right now saying, can you hear me?
anyway, in terms of privilege, I welcome anybody who's a pagan. I'm happy to share the experience, and I always say I'm only one kind of pagan. There's lots of kinds, and I'm only here. We are the most numerous, the most populous of which is by any means the only, and I can't speak for the other ones other than to say that they exist. I mentioned Druidry, for instance. You know, there are goddess groups
really
that are not
that
particularly witches.
The effective leadership and innovators out there seem to not be proprietary. You know, the people that are real proprietary about what they throw out there don't seem to be particularly the movers and the shakers. That brings me to an issue we kind of jumped over that I wanted to ask you about. You were talking about how we don't have like large congregations like a mosque or a temple or a Christian church. And I've heard people say that, you know, we don't have that because of the burning times. You know, we had to be very careful, and so you only had a very small group, so you could disperse really quickly. And then on the other hand, you know, people look at some of the institutions in other religions, and we tend to not be dogmatic, hierarchical as a whole. What do you see as the reason why we tend to just continue to do small groups rather than building the bigger infrastructure?
We do continue to do small groups. I'm going to tell you something that I picked up in my because I like to hang around with scholars. I picked this up in religious studies in the context of the American Academy of Religion. And that is a phenomenon that they call the Protestantization of religion. And the Protestant, by that, I mean when immigrant groups come to North America, which was primarily established in terms of a whole country, coast to coast, by Euro-Americans, who came here out of Christianity, primarily.
Right.
And mostly Protestant Christianity, that when they set up institutions after they arrive, they set them up on that model. They call this the Protestantization of religion. For instance, rabbis used to comment on the writings. They didn't like go visit the sick or have to run a temple or all that kind of stuff, which they do now because they're an officer in a synagogue in a different, you know, the synagogues are set up more, and I don't know a whole lot about how Jewish synagogues are set up, but they're more along the model of a Protestant church. And other groups have done the same thing, whether they would be that way or in their native place or country or not. And I think that also affects, we are all products of what I call the overculture. We Euro-Americans, we're all socialized in the same society. So we have internalized an awful lot of stuff from that study, and some of what we struggle with, even within paganism, we struggle with some of those assumptions that we don't necessarily have an awareness they're assumptions. So there are
right. There
are pagans and Wiccans in particular who are setting up churches. Well, people have been buying land for a long time, the whole back to nature utopian sort of motivation, which is very American. Boy, I've been doing a lot of research on various American movements, and there's a million utopian movements and utopian communities. But in any case, there are people, I think Christopher Penzack is, I think he's in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, in New England, anyway, has a church that they've been fussing with the local authorities about, and there are other groups that have had church. The first one was a woman named Lady Satana at the Ravenwood Church of Wicca in Atlanta, Georgia, back in the 70s, who broke it. She really broke the barrier for a lot of people, and they physically had, you know, a church. If you don't have an institution, then the the charismatic personality or personalities or the movers and shakers who created whatever it is, when they're gone, the institution, the group falls apart unless it has been, quote, institutionalized. You know, it's got some bylaws and stuff.
So how do you do that without, I mean, I think that many people in the pagan community have suffered under, you know, rigid hierarchy and sort of the patriarchal structure. And speaking of the ways that we're enculturated here is that, you know, our culture sees everything as this versus that, you know, two sides to everything. And I think a lot of pagans, ironically buying into that mainstream way of thinking, think, well, there's us and there's them. There's either, you know, oppressive patriarchal, hierarchical church or none at all. And we haven't really learned, I don't think, to finesse our way into a center view somewhere. So how would you, as a pagan with pagan values, develop an ongoing structure without falling into and centralized power in one person and all those things that make pagans nervous? What would a pagan church look like, in your view?
I don't know. We certainly, interfaith teaches you a lot about what to do and not to do and what goes wrong and what can go wrong and how you can address it. I can tell you that. I mean, just schmoozing with people who encounter something. Institutions, this is not a pagan church, but institutions, Cherry Hill Seminary is an institution, and it conforms to most generally accepted methods of operation, you know, open books and all that stuff. We're registered, you know, you can read our budget online because when you get a 501c3, that's part of it. Lots and lots of pagan organizations have managed to qualify for 501c3 tax status, nonprofit religious tax status, which is a start. One of the problems that I see is I don't see it as an either-or thing. I think it's a both-and, and I think it can also be enriched by various permutations, if you will, different ways of expressing similar things. I'm going to go to the big hierarchy word. I came out of a tradition that claimed that we had no hierarchy, that we're all consensus brought
in.
And in fact, that is not true. It was a noble ideal to which many people strove, towards which we strove. In fact, there's always been a clique, and there are always in all groups, not just that group.
So
there are people whose voices carry more weight. There are
Would you say that the individual's power over his path is therefore different than the institutions you're trying to create? Like what may work as your personal spirituality that you don't let anybody violate and you have control over is not the same thing as creating an institution where empowered people can come together. Does that make sense?
Oh, they're not the same thing at all. But I'm still trying to make a point. and I get
what are you saying, Maka?
I'm saying that I try to, but I'm in the middle of answering the question. It gets taken somewhere else, and so I don't get to say the whole thing. But what I want to say is there's hierarchy occurs in nature. It's not a bad thing. Hierarchy can be rotated. People should not be taking roles they're unsuited for just for the sake of egalitarianism. You don't want me in charge of the books because I don't. I mess them up. I wouldn't do a good job with them. But there are other people who are really good with stuff like that who wouldn't necessarily feel very comfortable standing in front of a group talking to people. So they shouldn't, unless they want to learn how to do that, need to be given the opportunity, shouldn't be forced into those roles any more than I should be forced to be a dancer at a particular public ritual because I'm not a dancer. I mean, that's not a flaw,
yeah.
It's not a shortcoming, it's just not a talent of mine. So I think trying to squeeze people into, for the sake of egalitarianism, squeeze people for roles that are suited for is not good. But on the other hand, holding on to things, particularly positions of power, is also not helpful in the long run. To some extent it is, but you train people to take over when you're gone. And another thing that I think is probably kind of problematic for a lot of pagans is when they're not parents, they don't always get that stuff. It's there's a thing about parenthood that does change, shift your perspective a little bit.
In my own research in the Celtic world, one of the things that I've been examining that was kind of hard for both the Greeks and the Romans to understand is that the Celtic propensity toward functional hierarchy.
There you are. You disappeared.
It's a hierarchy based on the function that somebody is doing. It doesn't make them better. It doesn't make them worse. They just happen to be the ones in charge of that particular thing because that's what they do. You know, and we associate hierarchy with, you know, vacuous guys up at the top that don't do any work at all, sending down the edicts to everybody else. And, and even in the professions in the old days, they had the guilds where the people doing the work were the ones that made the decisions for those. So it was not, you know, you're my boss because you get paid more than me and somebody decided you're my boss. Like, you're my boss because you're really, really good at this. Does that make sense to you?
Well, there's space because we are a brand new movement. There's space for all kinds of different expressions of institutional organization to manifest.
Yeah.
And some will be successful and some won't. And that's sort of the way of life. And, you know, some plants grow and some don't.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But I think we're wide open, and we also are in a position that we can learn from so many other sources. And, boy, do I ever... I learn a lot in interface. I do. Just from paying attention, not from necessarily doing anything.
Yeah. I had a guy move. I was trying to parallel park, and this guy pulled up in the one in front of me, and he just parked. He looked in his rear view mirror, saw I was trying to park behind him, and so he pulled up to make it really easy for me to pull in. And we both got out of the car. I looked at him and said, "Thank you for, you know, paying attention." Like, there's other things going on around you. He just kind of laughed. He knew exactly what I was talking about. Like, yeah, it's actually nice to go through the world listening to what's going on around you because it's an education always. So when you do innovation in I'm getting back to the ritual thing because that's something I'm very fascinated by. When you do innovation, just like the way we do hierarchy should be different than the patriarchal hierarchy. We've always prided ourselves in being a little bit different from a lot of people that come to paganism out of pain from the Christian church. You know, and yet, like you said, we tend to start repeating the same structure over and over again. What do you use as the controlling, not necessarily controlling factor, but the focus when you put together a ritual?
Depends on the ritual. I'm doing a lot of different things for these people at San Quentin right now, and one of the reasons is because they call it the Wiccan circle, but it's really kind of everything that's pagan that isn't Native American or African diaspora or heathen.
Right.
So, they're not necessarily going to be the same people all the time. I try to keep the focus. Well, I certainly have, in the case of this particular group that calls itself a Wiccan Circle, I have 8 Sabbats that are celebratory that I can have a focus with. And I, for instance, I tend to be very goddess oriented, and I tend to be very. You sing, you dance, you hug, you know, that kind of stuff, very personal. And I can't be most of those things in the context of inmate ministry.
Right.
We don't know about each other, and we're not supposed to know about each other, which is kind of weird, you know. I mean, I suppose the Catholic inmates have a priest to confess to, but, you know, and some of these people, as I said, have counselors who go to their cells. But, I had, at Samhain, I only called the Morrigan. I didn't even involve any male deity. And then at Yule, I feel these are men who probably, these are all men, of course, who probably haven't necessarily been exposed to models, holy models for want of a better term, that are useful for them to emulate. Anyway, I found a thing quite serendipitously. I guess it was a Hermaean, which is kind of an unexpected windfall from Hermes, just that recently. But I found online a colloquy by a guy named Dave the Bard, spelled D-A-V-E.
I love that word, colloquy. Druids use that a lot. I just think it's a way cool word.
Well, Dave the Bard, who spells his name D-A-M-H, Dave. Dave the Bard had a colloquy between the Oak King and the Holly King, which was basically seasonals. It was it was just beautiful. It's online. You can find it if you look up Dave the Bard.
He's with Obod, right? Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, he's in England. I never heard of him until I heard the name, but that's all. And I went to his website and I listened to it. I transcribed the whole thing. I printed it all out. It's just beautiful. And I couldn't take stuff in. I wanted, for altars, I like to have seasonal growing things. And I wanted to bring in some holly and some oak, but I couldn't. So I printed them off the internet and cut out every little piece of needle around the holly and all and oak leaves, and I put them all over the altar, which they could then take and put in their just paper and real lay it on the altar, actually. But I had them, I didn't even invoke a deity at all. I had them read this colloquy between the Oak King and had images of the Oak King and Holly King on the altar. So I thought these, again, were really limited, and imagery and visuals are really important, I think, for people. They're an enhancement.
Right.
And so we have these plastic stands that they're like display stands that you would see in a retail place that will hold a piece of paper. I got three of them, one horizontal, two vertical, and I changed the deities each time. And I had the green, I had a Holly King and an Oak King, yes, the two upright ones. Two of the people read that colloquy to one another. That was kind of the lesson of the season. Even though, again, it's from England and we're in California, and the people who are in there come from all over the place and are very, and I want you to know something that's, I think, really interesting. I have more minorities in that circle than I have Euro-Americans.
I'm proud of the fact that I live in what time called Sacramento, the most diverse city in the nation. We don't have a majority in the entire city. It's all, everybody's under 50%, and it's, I don't know, it makes it more fun and a lot of really cool restaurants. I have to interject, Mark. I know this is a little interruption, but you've just created this really wonderful picture in my head of this world-renowned priestess cutting out flowers at the table. That just makes me happy for some reason.
I do that. I cut out skulls for you. I do that kind of stuff a lot.
My grandmother, who was starting to develop dementia when I was a kid, there are two things that she used to do. She used to knit really badly, and then everybody would send their greeting cards with the flowers, and she would meticulously cut them out and paste them. She had these, like, stacks of scrapbooks with nothing but all these flowers, and they all called her crazy. I thought that was the most sane thing anybody in my family did. Anyway, so I just had to share that was a pretty cool picture you just put in my head.
Cutting out little paper flowers is a meditative art.
I want
to mention a couple of things before we run out of time.
My own
website, which is MachaNightmare.com. It is unfortunately not current, but it's really easy to find out who I am, what I do, and how to reach me. The other is my blog, which is Broomstick Chronicles. It's Besom, B-E-S-O-M, that's the broom,
Besom.blogspot.com.
Yeah, that's me. And the other is CherryHillSeminary.org. We need Cherry Hill Seminary. We need seminaries, pagan seminaries. We're really working towards accreditation. You need accreditation for certain things. I don't really care about it so much personally, but what it prevents us from working, for instance, the military, which has the most stringent requirements for chaplaincy. And there are a lot of chaplains in the military who are very pointedly and out front evangelical Protestant, and that's not a safe place for pagans to be known to be pagans. So I am, one of the reasons I'm pushing for the accreditation, and we really have a great relationship with the people in the military in South Carolina who do authorize. They've accepted our studies from one of our graduates and another one soon to come. So
Excellent.
That's the reason I'm doing this, is because the outside world requires it, not because I think that we as pagans necessarily need it.
Right.
So that's jerryhillseminary.org, cog.org I mentioned with the interfaith blogs, Wild Garden, and I want to just read part of a little, because I think it's important for all of us to be reminded of. It was written by a woman named Paula Wallowitz in Chicago. Blessed be and blessed are those who stand together, blessed be and blessed are those who stand alone. Those blessed be and blessed are those who work in silence, blessed be and blessed are those who shout and scream. Blessed be and blessed are the movers and the shakers. Blessed be and blessed are the dreamers, the dream.
That's beautiful. That reflects a lot of what I'm very passionate about in the future of paganism, is finding a way to, you know, break out of the this or that mentality and start valuing everybody's contribution, whether it's out front and flamboyant or quiet behind the scenes. You know, a true tribe works only when all people are empowered and all people come together for the benefit of each other. That was really beautiful. Who wrote that?
Thank you. Paula Wallowitz, W-A-L-O-W-I-T-Z.
Paula Wallowitz.
It's on a CD called Lunacy. Anyway, no, I think that it's, we need people that are artists, we need mystics, we need CPAs, you know, we need doctors, we need organizers. We need writers. We need typesetters. I mean,
exactly.
Plumbers.
I mean, people assume because I'm a good writer and I write on a computer that I know anything at all about computers or cars,
right,
or toasters, for that matter. You know, mechanical intelligence is not one of my gifts. If I don't have those people around me, I can't do anything. No, and
well, there are people
that's...
in groups that foster public ritual that think that if you're not really, you haven't really arrived unless you have a place in the spotlight. And sometimes it really wasn't such a good idea to put that person in the spotlight. The person could be doing
right.
the light better or the sound or something that's not as visible, but there's this whole thing about you're not really somebody unless you do public ritual in front of a bunch of people, and that's not the case, in my opinion. It's a big mistake. Giving people opportunities to stretch their wings and try ritual things in a bigger group is okay, but people a spot in the spotlight just because they put in the time and earned the right and they're lousy at it, it's stupid.
It
does not enhance the artistry, and I see ritual as an art form.
Yeah, so do I.
And I consider my personal art form is ritual.
I love that. Quick thing I wanted to go back to, if we have a little bit of time, Cherry Hill Seminary, is that focused toward like a postgraduate study, like after somebody already has a college degree? Does it include a college degree? At what level would people expect to study if they go there?
If you were seeking a graduate degree, an MDiv or a Master in Pagan Studies, then you would need to submit college transcripts, BA transcripts, BS transcripts, just like any other seminary. And you have to go through the whole routine that you would in any other graduate school. If we do have a program, what I think is called Rise Up, these keep changing, so I'm not quite up to date. One is called Rise Up, and there are certain courses, like four-week courses, just to kind of get the flavor of a particular topic you're interested in.
There's
and it
really
can be real
whole,
practical.
5 seconds.
It can
be real a whole variety of
like,
levels.
Thank you.
Sounds like we're getting music off. Thank you, Maka, so much. MakaNightmare.com. It's been a great show. You're an amazing person to interview. Take care.